Hello. Benjamin Britten was a central figure of 20th century music. His best known works include the opera Peter Grimes, his War Requiem, and the Young People's Guide to the Orchestra. Britten was a pacifist, and on the eve of the Second World War, he and his partner, the tenor Peter Pears, left England for the United States, but they never really settled. So in 1942, they decided to return home. And it was on that perilous journey across the Atlantic, battling storms and dodging U-boats, that Benjamin Britten wrote some of the carols that would eventually become part of a ceremony of carols, a short but very beautiful work for the high, clear voices of boy trebles, or women's choir, and a harp. It's a short piece, about 23 minutes, and today we'll be doing something a little different on Beyond Belief as we take a look at each of the carols and discuss their religious significance and listen to some wonderful music. So to discuss a ceremony of carols, we've a distinguished trio of musicians. Michael Barclay is a composer, broadcaster and crossbench peer. Benjamin Britten was his godfather. Anna Lapwood is a conductor, organist and director of music at Pembroke College, Cambridge. She was a professional harp player. And the Reverend Lucy Winkett is rector of St James's Piccadilly in the centre of London. Before that, she trained as a singer at the Royal College of Music. A ceremony of carols begins with the choir processing in, singing the words Hodie Christus Natus Est, Christ is born today. Michael, why do you think Britten chose to open the work with a processional hymn?
Well, don't forget, Britten was an operatic composer par excellence, and I think he knew the theatrical effect of this, but also the ritualistic quality of it. And having processed into Westminster Cathedral with those very notes, I can tell you that they work marvellously. They kind of set the tone for what is to follow.
Lucy, for you, does that set the tone? Does that set the piece up in a proper, even liturgical way?
Well, I think so, yes. It's a kind of quasi-liturgical opening to what's usually performed in a concert setting. And I think there's a theological point being made there too, because the theological meaning of Christmas is that God becomes human. So there's a movement from there to here. And actually, that's one of the reasons that we have processions in services at all, that we're illustrating the fact, really, that God has come to us from somewhere else, as it were, even though God's everywhere. So it's actually making quite a profound theological point right at the beginning of the piece.
Anna.
Yes, and I think whenever we hear chant like that, there's an element of nostalgia in there. But I think also the fact that the music almost comes into focus as the singers get closer to the audience, it's as if the audience or congregation are joining something which has already begun, something which exists in its own right outside of the concert setting as well.
And he was very clever in saying that you could repeat the last few lines until everybody was in their place. If nothing else, Britten was a fantastically practical composer.
We've had the first movement, which is the language of the church, Latin. And although that's quite an immediate message, Hodie Christus Natus Est, today Christ is born, it will have sounded quite ethereal. But then it's followed by these amazing chords from the harp. And you go into a kind of rowdy, bawdy, almost tavern type atmosphere. Welcome everyone. You can imagine you're in a kind of Canterbury Tales type pub and there's people jostling and, you know, they've heard that there's a birth of a child. It's very earthy. And that makes a strong contrast between God transcendent beyond us in the language of the church and God absolutely imminent in the dust and the dirt of the stable.
The choir has treated the audience to a boisterous welcome, and now it's time to get down to business, so the mood changes. It becomes more reverent. The next carol says there is no rose of such virtue as the rose that bore Jesus. It's a hymn to Mary. And the mood is gentle and prayerful. Lucy, this is from a 14th century poem by an anonymous author. What do you think that author means by comparing Mary to a rose?
This third movement, I think, is really interesting because it brings together the Latin and the English. It's in the tradition of what were known as macaronic carols, alternate lines of Latin and English. And describing Mary as the rose relates to the classic medieval doctrinal belief that Mary redeems the sin of Eve. Eve is the one who causes the fall in the Garden of Eden because she listens to the serpent and eats the apple. And so Mary redeems the sin of Eve, but supremely in the doctrine of the Incarnation, Christ redeems the sin of Adam, and Adam is representative of the whole human race. So there's that balance there between Latin and English, Eve and Mary, Adam and Christ, that kind of settles us down.
Yes, it's about contrast, isn't it? I mean, that we've just had a sort of, as you say, rousing movement. And now we go into something which is more andante and gentle.
And I think also you can't have a rose without thorns. And that sort of the contrast between the beauty and the pain is something that I think it pervades this entire sequence.
Mary is central stage at this part of the piece. The choir has been singing about Mary, and now we have two solos which are sung by Mary, two lullabies sung to the baby Jesus. And the first one says, when that young child began to weep with song, she lulled him to sleep.
That younger child, when it can weep, with song she
Michael, many people have reflected that there is an innocence to a ceremony of carols, which is clearly heard in this movement.
Yes, and I think the way he just uses that semitone at the beginning, da-da-dee, da-da-dee, and it sort of backs away on the second note, is extraordinarily evocative. And I think part of Britten's genius was, if you look at a score of Britten, I'm sure Anna would agree, it's remarkable by what's not there. It's very spare, but everything that is there just speaks so strongly, and that's an example of that. I think the kind of gentleness, the almost weeping, actually, that sound, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's the thing. It's not a kind of, you can't say it's a happy innocence. It's a complex emotion. And I guess that's one of the joys of music, isn't it? That it can somehow make sense of these more complicated emotions. So yes, there's that weeping, da 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 da, and then this almost chant-like melody that for me always takes me back to that first processional movement, accompanied by the weeping in the harp. It sums up a very complicated relationship with the innocence of childhood, I think.
Lucy, do you hear that innocence in this piece?
I think it's a cross between a lullaby and a lament, actually. It's not just a straightforward lullaby. I'm really struck by that first line, that younger child, when it gan weep. And that's in stark contrast, isn't it, to the Christmas carol, Away in a manger, no crying he makes. There's a Victorian sense sometimes that Jesus isn't a real baby. But here, you could say that the shadow of the cross falls across the cradle right from the beginning. Jesus is weeping as a child. And, you know, you get that sense of the child who is born to die. It's an incredibly emotive and complex set of emotions.
Michael, there has been some controversy about Britten. It's known that he was gay. He enjoyed the company of young boys. He wrote a lot of music for their voices. And we know that he became very close to the actor David Hemmings, among others, when David Hemmings was in his teens. Now, you knew David Hemmings, and I know you discussed this with him.
Yes, I was one of the boys that, apart from being my godfather, I worked with Ben quite a lot. I sang in the choir. We sang this to him. And I think the answer to this is, and I talked to David Hemmings and I talked to John Pridcut, who made a film about it, is that Britton, he was very boy-like himself. He was more comfortable with children than he was with adults. It was not sexual. It was very warm and gentle, rather like the music we've just heard. And all of those boys that I knew said the same thing to me, that he was fatherly in a way. I think he wished he'd had children, you know. He would have loved to have had children. And he was living in an age when it was illegal to be homosexual. He came from a very sort of conservative background with a small c. His father was a dentist. So he was living, if you like, a kind of lie. And I think that feeds into a lot of his music and this concern about the corruption of innocence.
I think it's also worth bearing in mind, obviously, that we talk about all his work with boys' choirs, but that there weren't really girl choristers at that stage. So if he wanted to work with a children's choir, it had to be boys.
Michael, it's a carol of commitment. He says, I shall rock thee to my heart and never more from thee depart. Was Britton a religious man?
Well, I don't think he was, in practical terms, very religious. I don't think he went to church that much. I think for lots of us who are musicians, music, in a sense, is our religion. You know, there's a Christian ethic that you should make the most of what you're given. And I think that for a lot of people who are involved in music, it is a kind of transcending occupation which takes one closer to some sort of spirituality. So I'm not sure that he was profoundly religious. My father, Lennox, who knew him very, very well, always felt that there was fantastic brilliance and artifice in his writing rather than necessarily deep religious fervour.
Lucy, to me, the music resonates with the meaning of the words. And I wonder, does it matter to you when you're singing if you understand that Britton was not particularly religious? Does it make a difference?
I love the thought that Augustine said, you know, the one who sings prays twice, that it is in itself an expression of faith and spirituality. And in that sense, I suppose you could say music even writes its own doctrine. And as a priest, I'm grateful for that.
Anna, do you sense the spirituality in this music?
Well, I think, firstly, I'd just say I completely agree with what both Lucy and Michael have said, in that I think a lot of church musicians actually wouldn't say they are religious, but I think almost all of us would have had some occasion in our lives when we've been sitting, participating in some kind of church music and have had a spiritual experience and have had something which points us towards something greater and bigger and makes us feel part of something larger. And so I guess, yes, as Michael says, music is our religion and points us towards religion in some way.
Michael, what was he like as a godfather?
He was the godfather I will never be myself. He never forgot a birthday or Christmas. And when I was at Westminster Cathedral as a chorister, where we sang so many carols, every Christmas, every birthday, an envelope would arrive with £5 or £10 in it. And he also looked at my music, which was pretty embarrassing at that point, but would still send me back notes. So I was rather in awe of him and found it difficult not to love him in a way.
As dew in April, the focus returns to Mary and the great event of the Annunciation. And they are lovely words, Lucy. I sing of a maiden that is matchless. Her son was the king of all kings. From his mother he came to us quietly, as dew in April, falling on the grass. It suggests the delicacy of the whole idea of the virgin conceiving.
And it brings spring into December, doesn't it? I mean, you know, obviously we perform this piece around Christmas time, and it's cold. And then suddenly in this movement, you know, that the sun is out, there's dew on the grass, and it's April. And it's reminding us of the Feast of the Annunciation, which is the angel Gabriel coming to tell Mary that she is to bear God into the world. It's a very beautiful and, as you say, a rather delicate festival, rather too accurately, perhaps, celebrated on the 25th of April, which is exactly 9 months before Christmas Day. And this is a really, it's taking us back to that moment before Mary met Jesus, as it were. And it's, again, the focus is on Mary, but it's reminding us of how this whole story started. And it is a really beautiful spring day. It's like the sun comes out in what's rather a wintry piece.
The next carol is a big contrast with what has gone before. It's much darker. It describes a battle with Satan and the forces of evil.
It is absolutely thrilling to sing this piece, this particular movement, because it's intricate. The words are quite complicated. You have to practice them. There's lots of kind of consonants tumbling over each other. And those three parts are really fast moving and exciting to sing. It's odd that, you know, Britain can make redemption fun in a kind of weird way, because on medieval altar pieces, you'll often see a rather beautiful and perhaps pastel nativity scene with a donkey and an ox and Mary and Jesus. Everyone's looking quite calm. And then just underneath, there's hell. There's absolute hell breaking loose, quite literally, because Adam is being pulled up out of hell, reminding us that the meaning of the incarnation is that Satan is vanquished forever. So it does sound disturbing to modern ears, this kind of theology, but actually it's classically orthodox Christian understanding of what Christmas means.
And I think to follow on from that, again, if you're working with a children's choir, this is the movement that they all desperately want to sing. It's the thing they look forward to every year. They have huge grins on their faces.
The Ceremony of Carols, Michael, was originally written for women's voices, but he decided it was better suited to boys. Do you think he was right?
Yes, I do, because I think, as we've all perhaps suggested, there is a kind of innocence in boys. I mean, it does sound beautiful with girls, and it's often done with girls now, quite rightly, but I think there is something about Britain's sensitivity to timbre, which means that the boys' voices hit it right. And when he came to hear us sing it at Westminster, he was so excited by the slightly more metallic sound in our voices, the Mediterranean sound, very suited to Victoria and Palestrina, that he agreed to write a mass for us, which actually coincided more or less with my arriving at Westminster Cathedral. So I think it clearly was very important. It's an instrument, it's a colour, and it just excited him, I think.
Anna, this is an interlude for a solo harp, and it recaps previously heard themes, and it is quite beautiful and evanescent and ethereal. Is it a joy to play?
It is. I, in fact, can't listen to it without getting quite emotional, if I'm honest. It is, in my view, one of the best pieces of harp writing out there. And he just seems to get the instrument so perfectly. I mean, it's written all in flats, so that means all of our pedals are up, so the strings are in their most natural position. They resonate much better in flat keys. He asks the harpist to use harmonics all the way through, which create this bell-like effect. But then from a theological perspective, we have the Hodie Christus Natus Est chant appearing in the right hand, and then that is put against the Salve Regina chant in the left hand. So at the centrepiece of the whole work, he brings together the mother and child, and I just think it is one of the most moving pieces of music I can think of.
In freezing winter night, behold a helpless, tender babe. Lucy, this is evoking no cosy Dickensian Christmas. This is chilly music. You can feel the cold.
You can, but the metaphor of the coldness really helps us understand the sense of foreboding that's in this stable. And I think that's astonishingly powerful. It is chilly music. This child doesn't stay an innocent baby in a beautiful manger. This child disrupts and is persecuted and then executed. And cross, the shape of the cross to come, is really powerful, particularly in this movement.
Michael, it reminds me a bit of the paintings, the Renaissance paintings, where the infant Jesus is the shadow of a cross hanging over him.
Yes, and I think that's absolutely the right description for the way he treats the voices that kind of overlap and clash against each other. And they suggest something which are like waves coming into the shore, but which could at any moment begin to turn ugly. And of course, Britain was very good at dealing with waves and the sea. He used to go and swim in the North Sea every day, whatever the weather and whatever the temperature. And that's why he wrote so wonderfully in Peter Grimes and Billy Budd. But there is a kind of, to me, a sort of lyrical ebb and flow here, which has an ominous nature to it.
Anna?
I think the way he writes for the harp here achieves the same thing. He's put bispigliando into the hands. So again, this is where you repeat notes very, very quickly between the two hands. And what happens is, as you replace your fingers onto the strings, it creates a very, very small buzz. Not intrusive in any way, just a tiny sound. And for me, that always feels a little bit like the ice cracking every time there's one of these tiny buds. So he's done something very clever here in the harp writing.
Michael, the Spring Carol. There are echoes here of the Spring Symphony.
Absolutely. That was 1949, so it was only a few years off. And it was almost as though he was getting ready for it, because that one talks about lambs, gambling, and things like that. But as a boy, I used to adore the melody here. Pleasure it is to hear it was with the birdies sing, the deer in the dale, the sheep in the vale, the corn springing. It was just a wonderful opportunity to something which was set so lyrically and so naturally. He was a wonderful word setter, and, you know, probably the greatest we had since Purcell.
The final carol, Deo Gratias, Adam Leibinden.
I think that the placement of this meditation on the meaning of Christ and his relationship to Adam, the placement of this theological statement right at the end, is important. The enormity of the meaning of the incarnation is reinforced here right at the end. There's a decisiveness about it in the music as well as in the theology, that Christ has changed everything. And the context of all of that is thankfulness. Deo gratias, thanks be to God. So our response as listeners and as participators in this piece is to give thanks. What for? That Christ has redeemed the sin of Adam. That's it.
I think you're totally right. And I think that decisivity is actually written into the music. So the fact that the harp plays près de la table, so right at the bottom of the string next to the soundboard. So there's no resonance, really. It's a very, very short sound. The voices are singing staccato. It's not kind of indulgent in any way. But the other thing I would also say is, just to return for one last time to this idea of enjoyment. The way he writes the vocal parts in the Deo Gratias with these very short, snappy rhythms, you can hear it again with a young choir. I mean, if you stand in front of a children's choir while they sing this, their faces just light up. It's a wonderful moment.
Our time is almost up. A final question. What is the lasting appeal of this piece, Michael?
I think that it's a celebration of the world we live in, of the story of Christ through music. So the music becomes a cathartic experience to celebrate what is an extraordinary and always moving story. And the book ending with Gregorian plain chant is for me a masterstroke.
Anna?
I think the big thing for me is the nostalgia. I think the Gregorian chant instantly brings a sense of nostalgia. I think using the Middle English text, and I think instances of modal harmony as well. But then this idea of enjoyment for the performers, I think that will always come through to an audience.
Lucy?
Perhaps it's one of those pieces that it doesn't matter if you're hearing it for the first time or singing it for the 200th time. There's a freshness about it that addresses me at my point of wanting to know what life's all about, really. It addresses me in my confusion, and it kind of gives me a reassurance that somewhere the battle is over, somewhere the weapons are laid down, somewhere there is peace, even in that birth of the child. And I think even if you're not somebody with a Christian faith, I feel that somehow it's telling us the truth about what it is to be alive.
The Recessional, and that is the book ending to which Michael referred. And there we must leave A Ceremony of Carols. My thanks to Lucy Winkett, Anna Lapwood and Michael Barclay. The choir recesses, repeating the words heard at the top of the piece. Hodie Christus natus est, today is Christ born. And I can't think of a better way to wish you all a very happy Christmas.